Imagine for a second that you are a pastor. You're running this growing, super vibrant church.
Okay, setting the scene.
Right. But for weeks, you've just sensed this strange, suffocating tension in the room.
Like a heavy atmosphere, yeah.
Exactly. So you investigate, and you finally uncover and then publicly expose what you believe to be a literal, suspected occult ring operating in secret right inside your congregation.
Wow. I mean, the tension there would just be absolutely sky high.
Oh, it's intense. But then, that exact same day, $30,000 worth of your church's audiovisual and broadcasting equipment just inexplicably, catastrophically explodes.
A total meltdown.
A complete meltdown. Now, you have to ask yourself, you know, is that just incredibly bad luck? Is it just some bizarre coincidence? Or is it a literal physical manifestation of an unseen spiritual attack?
That's the exact kind of high-stakes, seemingly impossible scenario we're looking at today. Because, you know, when you enter the framework we are about to examine, coincidence just, it does not exist.
Right, none at all.
Everything is strategic. Everything has a source.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we have a really highly specific, practically focused mission for you, the listener.
Yeah, we're tackling a question that has honestly plagued human organizations for centuries.
But we're looking at it through a very, very unique lens. The question is basically this: how do you identify when an organization has been infiltrated by wolves in sheep's clothing?
Right, like what are the empirical signs?
Yeah, what are their specific techniques of subversion? How would you actually know if the rot is already, you know, operating inside the house?
So to explore this, we are drawing from a really fascinating stack of sources focused entirely on the charismatic Christian movement and their specific paradigms regarding spiritual warfare.
We're talking some pretty intense material here.
Definitely. We're dissecting teachings from Mark Dixon of Deep Waters, the highly publicized and, you know, controversial accounts of Pastor Greg Locke,
oh, yeah,
plus writings from prophetic minister Jennifer LeClaire, and this theological synthesis document that details counter-infiltration strategies against what they term occult agents.
And just to be clear, in their vernacular, they are talking quite literally about witches and warlocks operating covertly within congregations.
Literal witches, yes.
Now, before we go one step further, we need to make a very explicit, firm statement to you.
Very important point here.
Yeah, because the sources we are unpacking today contain intense, highly spiritually and politically charged viewpoints.
They deal heavily with concepts of, like, literal demonic entities, spiritual warfare, curses, and the active presence of witchcraft.
Right. So we want to be absolutely clear. We're not taking sides here.
Not at all.
We are not endorsing the theological, spiritual, or political viewpoints of the original authors, nor are we dismissing them, to be fair.
Exactly. Our objective is strictly, unapologetically impartial. We're just here to report on, dissect, and analyze the concepts.
The framework.
Right. The frameworks and ideas contained in this original source material, purely for your intellectual exploration.
We just want to understand the architecture of this worldview. Like, how does a specific community define an existential internal threat? How do they identify it? And how do they eradicate it?
It's fascinating from an organizational standpoint alone.
It really is. Okay,
yeah.
Let's unpack this. Because setting the stage here requires a massive paradigm shift from how we normally view the world.
Yeah, you have to kind of leave your standard assumptions at the door.
Right. If you or I hear the word infiltrator, our secular brains probably jump straight to, like, corporate espionage.
Oh, sure. You picture a disgruntled employee stealing trade secrets on a flash drive.
Yeah, or a mole in a spy movie, right? It's physical, it's material, it's usually about data or money.
But according to these sources, infiltration is not merely a physical act. It is a highly coordinated, systematic, spiritual subversion of authority.
And that distinction is the foundation of literally everything we're going to discuss today.
In this paradigm, you are not just dealing with a bad employee or, you know, a toxic personality.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a coordinated, unseen effort to introduce chaos, establish ungodly footholds, and systematically dismantle a community's spiritual and physical infrastructure right from the inside out.
Which means we can't just look for someone acting suspiciously by the filing cabinets.
Right, you have to look deeper.
We have to understand the psychology and really the spiritual profile of the infiltrator. Like,
yeah.
Who actually is the wolf? Is it always some conscious saboteur twisting their mustache in the shadows?
Or is the reality far more complex?
Exactly. And Mark Dixon from Deep Waters provides this framework that categorizes these subversive forces into four distinct types. And I have to say, the nuance here is really surprising.
It is incredibly layered. So Dixon's first category is what he calls the intentional or high-level infiltrator.
Okay.
This is the conscious agent. In the context of these sources, these are individuals actively involved in covens, the occult, or specific demonic rituals. Fine. Their deliberate stated goal is to infiltrate a church, blend in by presenting themselves as devout Christians, and disrupt the ministry.
Now wait, stop right there, because I think a lot of listeners might be a little confused by the motivation here.
How so?
Well, why would a coven care about some random suburban church? Like, what is the strategic value in this theological framework?
Okay. In the charismatic paradigm, it all comes down to the concept of territorial spirits and spiritual authority.
Okay.
A thriving, spiritually vibrant church is viewed as a direct threat to the demonic hierarchy governing a specific geographic area or city.
Like taking back territory.
Exactly. The church is actively pulling people out of darkness. They're breaking curses, shifting the spiritual atmosphere.
Wow. Okay.
Therefore, the intentional infiltrator is essentially sent on a military assignment by their spiritual superiors to neutralize that threat. They know exactly who they serve and what they are doing.
Okay, so that is the conscious saboteur. But Dixon's second category shifts into a much grayer area.
It does.
He calls this the cultural or pagan infiltrator. And these are individuals who might not consider themselves witches or Satanists at all.
Not even a little bit.
Right. They're operating through ancestral traditions, maybe cultural rituals or syncretism, which is basically the blending of different religious beliefs.
And the mechanism here is crucial to understand. The sources argue that these individuals might not have conscious malice toward the church at all.
They might just think they're doing what their family always does.
Exactly. They might genuinely believe they are just practicing a family tradition. But, and this is key within the strict legalistic framework of charismatic spiritual warfare, engaging in these practices constitutes an open door.
An open door for what?
Well, by practicing these unauthorized rituals, they are unknowingly creating a legal landing pad for demonic chaos, confusion, and instability to enter the organization.
Oh, I see. It's like they're walking into a totally sterile operating room wearing muddy boots.
That's a great way to put it.
They don't mean to infect the patient, but they are carrying the contamination in nonetheless.
Right. The intent doesn't negate the consequence.
Right. But the third category, this is the one that completely blew my mind.
The blind infiltrator.
Yes. Dixon calls this the blind or unaware infiltrator.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the psychology gets incredibly relatable, honestly, even way outside of a church context.
Yeah, break that down. How so?
Well, Dixon describes this person as someone who genuinely believes they are righteous. Like they firmly believe they are a devout Christian.
Okay.
But they operate entirely through the mechanics of fear, control, and manipulation. Dixon explicitly notes that these individuals pray what he calls prayers of control.
Yeah, that's a wild concept.
They use religious language to actually wish harm on others. Or they pray things like, Lord, bring them down until they submit to me.
What's fascinating here is that introduces one of the most vital theological mechanisms in this entire deep dive, the concept of the power of agreement.
The power of agreement, right.
In this spiritual framework, the demonic realm doesn't necessarily need you to sign a contract in blood or, you know, wear a name tag that says spy for the dark side.
It would make us too easy.
Right. Demonic entities operate through the fundamental mechanics of rebellion, fear, and manipulation. That is their nature.
So if a person naturally utilizes those toxic behavioral mechanics to get their way in a church.
Exactly. If they use manipulation and control, they inadvertently act as a conduit for those demonic forces.
Right.
They come into agreement with the destructive spirit simply by manifesting its characteristics.
Wow.
When they pray a prayer of control, asking God to force someone to submit to their will, they're actually engaging in a form of witchcraft. Because witchcraft, fundamentally, in this view, is the manipulation of another person's free will.
I want to translate this for a second, because looking at this from a purely secular organizational psychology standpoint,
yeah,
it perfectly mirrors the concept of a toxic middle manager in corporate America.
Oh, the Bluetooth or Wi-Fi analogy works perfectly here.
Yes. Think of it like a localized, unsecured Wi-Fi network. You have a middle manager who genuinely, in their heart of hearts, believes they are saving the company.
They're the hero of their own story.
Always. They think they're the only one holding the department together. but their management style is micromanagement, fear, and demanding total submission.
Right.
They aren't a hacker. They don't wake up wanting to destroy the company, but their toxic behavior acts as an unsecured network. They unwittingly leave the back door wide open for malware to enter the system,
causing high turnover, destroying morale.
Exactly. Rotting the company from the inside. They are a blind infiltrator.
That is a phenomenal secular translation of Dixon's spiritual concept. They are broadcasting a signal that invites destruction.
It's so insidious because they don't even know they're doing it.
And this naturally leads right into Dixon's fourth category, which is really a warning directed squarely at the general congregation, the misaligned believer.
This is the person who just sort of slowly fades into darkness, right?
Yeah, precisely. These are ordinary members of the organization who have stepped out of alignment with what the Bible calls the fruit of the Spirit. You know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness.
So what happens to them?
Well, the sources argue that when a believer nurses an offense, or allows bitterness to take root, or steps into unchecked pride, they compromise their spiritual immune system.
Ah, I see.
They knowingly harbor a grievance, and by doing so, they unknowingly come into agreement with darkness, allowing themselves to be used as pawns by higher-level infiltrators to create division.
Okay, so we have this really comprehensive profile matrix now. We have the intentional warlock sent on a mission, the cultural practitioner tracking in mud, the blind controller opening the Wi-Fi network to malware, and the bitter congregant acting as a useful idiot.
Right, that's the lineup.
We know who the wolves are. But here's the massive question for you, the listener.
Mm-hmm.
If you are running an organization and these people are this dangerous, how do they actually get inside?
Good question.
How do they embed themselves into the core of a community without setting off every single alarm bell in the building?
Well, if your ultimate goal is subversion, you obviously cannot arrive looking like the enemy.
Right. You'd be stopped at the door.
You have to camouflage yourself in the native environment. And in a highly religious, charismatic environment, the absolute most effective camouflage is extreme performative devotion.
Wow.
The sources call this the ultra-spiritual persona.
Which is completely counterintuitive.
Oh, totally.
If you are a leader, whether you're in a church or a business, you are almost always looking out for the cynic. You are looking for the rebel.
It's a squeaky wheel.
Right. The person complaining in the parking lot, the one rolling their eyes during the meeting. You think that is the threat.
Mm.
But this framework flips that entirely. It says, no, the wolf is the person pretending to be the absolute most dedicated sheep in the flock.
Yeah. They don't just sit in the back row and observe. Their zeal is weaponized.
Weaponized zeal.
They actively try to outpray, outworship, and outserve everyone else. They are the first ones at the altar and the last ones to leave. They want to be perceived as the most spiritually in tune, highly sensitive members of the entire congregation.
And just think about why that works so brilliantly. It's a form of spiritual gaslighting.
Exactly.
If you, as a pastor, feel uncomfortable around this person, they have perfectly positioned themselves to make you look like the bad guy.
Right, if you tell them to tone it down.
They can just turn to the congregation and say, oh, the pastor's quenching the Holy Spirit. He's threatened by my anointing.
Yep. They use the rules of the group to bypass the accountability of the group.
It's manipulative genius.
It is. The ultra-spiritual persona provides them with a shield. Mm-hmm. And they use that shield to execute their second major tactical move, strategic placement.
Okay, so where do they go once they have the shield?
Because they project this intense devotion, they often seek and secure rapid promotion into leadership positions. But even more insidiously, they don't always aim for the main stage. No. They specifically target close-knit, intimate ministry groups. Pastor Greg Locke, in his very public accounts, specifically noted finding these individuals deeply embedded in his wife's ladies' Bible study.
Now, let me deduce this, because initially I thought, why target a small, intimate Bible study? Why not try to get on the elder board or preach on Sunday morning?
It seems like the obvious power play.
Right. But targeting the main stage means dealing with the senior pastor's direct oversight.
Mm-hmm.
It means heavy scrutiny. A small ladies' Bible study, on the other hand, is generally unguarded.
It all comes down to proximity and vulnerability.
Right. People go to those small groups to share their deepest traumas. They are crying. They're sharing marital problems. They're talking about their wayward children.
It's raw.
It is a goldmine of raw human vulnerability. If someone wants to build leverage and control, what better place to go than where everyone is voluntarily handing over their deepest secrets?
You've hit the nail on the head. In those intimate settings, prayer teams, counseling sessions, small groups, the infiltrator positions themselves as the ultimate trusted confidant, the hyperspiritual mentor.
Gaining all that trust.
Right. They establish personal control over key, vulnerable segments of the congregation, completely away from the spotlight and the direct oversight of the main leadership. They are building a shadow government.
They're essentially siphoning off the loyalty of the sheep while the shepherd is looking the other way.
Exactly.
And that transition from positioning themselves in a small group to actually draining the organization, that brings us to the terrifying specific techniques of subversion they use.
Yeah, the actual mechanics.
Right. Once they have that vulnerable person alone in a counseling session, what are the actual mechanics of the attack? The sources highlight two primary, highly destructive methods: the establishment of soul ties and the weaponization of false prophecy for emotional and financial extraction.
Let's unpack the soul ties first, because this term is ubiquitous in charismatic circles, but it requires specific definition here.
Definitely.
The synthesis document explains that during intense ministry sessions, such as deep counseling, deliverance, or the laying on of hands for prayer, these agents actively establish ungodly codependent relationships.
Okay.
They bypass the actual pastoral authority to make the vulnerable person entirely obsessively dependent on them for spiritual validation.
Explain the ELI-5 mechanics of a soul tie in this theology. Because psychologically, we can call it severe codependency or trauma bonding.
Right.
But they view this as a literal spiritual mechanism, right?
Yes, absolutely. In this framework, a soul tie is viewed as an invisible spiritual umbilical cord connecting two individuals.
An umbilical cord, wow.
Right. When it is a godly soul tie, like between a healthy husband and wife, it allows for the flow of love, support, and spiritual strength.
Okay, that makes sense.
But an ungodly soul tie forged by an infiltrator is a mechanism for spiritual siphoning. Through manipulation and intense emotional bonding, the infiltrator attaches this cord to the victim.
So it travels through it.
They use it to transfer demonic oppression, anxiety, or confusion into the victim while simultaneously draining the spiritual vitality and emotional energy out of the believer.
So the victim walks away from a prayer session feeling exhausted, confused, and just desperate to go back to the infiltrator to feel fixed again.
Precisely. The infiltrator makes themselves the indispensable mediator between the victim and God. They whisper things like, "The pastor doesn't understand your depth, but I do. God speaks to me about you."
Oh, that's so toxic.
The ultimate goal is to bind the person so tightly to the infiltrator that they create a splinter faction within the church that is completely loyal to the wolf, not the shepherd.
And if the soul tie is the emotional extraction, Jennifer LeClaire's writings dive deep into the financial and informational extraction through what she calls false prophecy.
Yes, this part is wild.
She issues severe warnings about Christian psychics who invade the church. Now, she notes that instead of operating through the Holy Spirit, they use divination, or what they call familiar spirits. And this is a concept we absolutely have to break down for the listener, because familiar spirit sounds like a ghost story, but it has a very specific theological definition here.
It is a crucial distinction.
Yeah.
Because in secular terms, we might look at a psychic who accurately tells you about your deceased grandmother and assume they're either doing a brilliant polled read or they're actually talking to your grandmother's ghost.
Right.
But charismatic theology explicitly rejects the idea that humans can communicate with the dead.
Right. The dead are either in heaven or hell. They aren't hanging around doing parlor tricks.
Exactly. So how does the psychic know that your grandmother always wore a specific blue brooch?
Yeah, how?
The theological explanation is the familiar spirit. This is a demonic entity that was literally familiar with your grandmother. It observed her life, it saw the blue brooch, and now it communicates that historically accurate information to the psychic. The psychic then uses that astoundingly accurate secret information to hook the victim.
That is a massive aha moment for understanding this worldview. The accuracy of the psychic isn't proof they are from God. The demonic realm has access to historical facts.
Exactly.
So the infiltrator uses this familiar spirit to perform what looks like a miraculous prophetic revelation. And LeClaire points out that the spirit behind this revelation is designed strictly to manipulate, not to edify.
And they blend this cold reading and demonic intel with charismatic jargon to camouflage the operation.
And the examples she gives of this manipulation are wild, particularly the financial extraction. She outlines how these infiltrators use twisted scripture to extort money. There's this shockingly specific example of false prophets demanding a monetary seed of exactly $54.17 from vulnerable congregants.
Yes. And the psychological manipulation behind that specific number is based on twisting a very famous Bible verse, Isaiah 54:1c, which says, "No weapon formed against you shall prosper."
Right. So picture this. An infiltrator identifies a single mother who is terrified of losing her job and her home.
Someone very vulnerable.
Yeah. They use that hyper-spiritual persona. They claim to have a prophetic word. And they tell her, "The enemy has formed a weapon against your finances. But the Lord told me that if you sow a seed of exactly $54.17 into my ministry right now, it will unlock God's divine protection over your life."
They are turning biblical stewardship into transactional sorcery. It's an extortion racket dressed up as faith. Like, pay me the 54 bucks or the demons are going to destroy your life.
And LeClaire even mentions an incredibly base physical technique where these false prophets literally peek at congregants offering envelopes while their eyes are supposedly closed in deep prayer.
Oh, that's just slimy.
Yeah. They memorize the names and the amounts, and then later in the service, they call those people out, faking prophetic insight about their finances to build awe and demand even more money.
If we look at the underlying mechanics of this, what these infiltrators are fundamentally doing is weaponizing human grief and vulnerability. LeClaire specifically notes a horrific pattern where these individuals target people who are grieving unimaginable tragedies, like the loss of children to suicide.
That is predatory behavior at its absolute worst. You have a parent desperately searching for comfort, desperate for reassurance that their child is okay.
Right.
The infiltrator steps in, uses divination, familiar spirits, or just cruel cold reading tactics to offer a false sense of connection. And in doing so, they extract immense, unshakable loyalty and resources from the victim.
It is psychological abuse wrapped in a prayer shawl, which brings up a critical juncture for you, the listener, especially if you manage people or lead a community.
So what does this all mean for leadership? Like, how can a leader possibly tell the difference between someone genuinely, clumsily ministering to a grieving mother and a highly skilled infiltrator establishing a toxic, codependent soul tie?
That is the ultimate pastoral nightmare. Because the psychological tactics of subversion are so subtle and they mimic authentic care so well that subjective discernment just isn't always enough.
You can't just guess.
Now, this is why the sources insist that leadership must look for external physical validation. According to this framework, an active occult agent leaves empirical physical red flags in their wake. They argue that spiritual rot eventually warps the physical floorboards.
This is where our deep dive takes a sharp turn into the physical realm. The sources argue you must track the physical chaos surrounding a suspected individual. And the first major category of this empirical evidence is sudden, inexplicable, and incredibly costly physical disruption, specifically catastrophic equipment failure.
And this loops us right back to the vivid scenario we opened the deep dive with. Pastor Greg Locke's public account provides the textbook example of this. He cited a sudden, completely inexplicable $30,000 loss in audiovisual and broadcasting equipment damage.
And the most critical detail is the timing. This massive equipment failure coincided exactly with his public exposure and confrontation of suspected witches within his church.
Now, anyone who has worked in live production, theater, or church media knows that soundboards glitch.
Oh, constantly. Cables go bad, bulbs burn out.
It is a fact of life. But a $30,000 catastrophic meltdown on the exact day you are battling internal saboteurs, the sources say that is absolutely not a coincidence.
In their theological framework, why do you think a demonic entity would specifically target a soundboard or broadcasting equipment?
Because the equipment is the mechanism for broadcasting the message.
Okay.
If the church's mission is to preach a gospel that supposedly breaks demonic power, then neutralizing the microphone and the live stream is a direct tactical strike on the organization's primary weapon.
Exactly. It is a manifestation of the spiritual attack hitting the physical infrastructure designed to spread the opposing message. But the physical red flags extend far beyond just the infrastructure. They impact the actual biology of the people involved.
Yeah, this part is crazy.
The second major physical red flag is widespread, highly unusual physical sickness.
Yes, the sources state that a consistent sign of an active infiltrator in the congregation is the sudden onset of intense physical illness among the people who associate with them. It's almost like the infiltrator is spiritually radioactive.
That is a very apt description. If a pastor spends hours counseling them, or a well-meaning member befriends them, they suddenly get hit with extreme exhaustion, brain fog, or bizarre, untreatable ailments.
The spiritual draining we discussed with soul ties manifests biologically.
Yes. Locke even reported that his own face broke out in severe, inexplicable physical symptoms after a marathon deliverance session with a suspected infiltrator that lasted until 2:15 in the morning.
And it isn't just physical sickness. It is what the sources call atmospheric oppression. This isn't just one person catching a cold. It is a dense, suffocating concentration of relational and emotional breakdowns across the core leadership team.
We are talking about sudden outbreaks of severe domestic discord, unexplained, heavy depression, or even sudden divorces among key leadership families who were previously completely stable and healthy.
If we connect this back to the bigger picture at the organizational level, what the experts in these sources are demanding is that leaders look for statistical anomalies.
Right.
A broken microphone is just a maintenance issue. A married couple having a bad fight is just human nature. But if your sound system explodes, your perfectly healthy youth pastor gets inexplicably, violently ill, and three of your elders file for divorce in the exact same month that a highly intense, hyper-spiritual new member worms their way into the inner circle.
That's a pattern.
That statistical anomaly is the primary empirical diagnostic marker that you have a wolf actively tearing the house down.
Precisely. The physical and atmospheric chaos is the literal footprint of the infiltrator. But alongside those physical breakdowns, the sources argue that infiltrators utilize specific unseen vectors to manipulate that spiritual atmosphere. This brings us to the spiritual red flags and the primary vectors of contamination.
This part reads straight out of a thriller novel.
It really does. Mm. The sources describe how these unseen attacks actually manifest to the victims before the physical chaos even hits. The first major spiritual red flag is synchronized, demonic dream assaults.
Yeah,
we are talking about members of the leadership simultaneously starting to experience severe nightmares, night terrors, or sleep paralysis. And Mark Dixon shared an incredibly visceral, chilling example of this from his own life.
Yes. Dixon recounted a highly specific dream. In the dream, he was lying on the ground, and an incredibly angry dog was standing right over his face, just staring at him with malice.
Terrifying.
Later in that exact same dream, the scenery shifted, and he was being actively hunted and lunged at by a polar bear. He woke up, recognized the intense spiritual weight of it, categorized it as a demonic assignment against his life, and spent an hour in intense prayer canceling the assignment.
But the crazy part, the part that validates this framework for him, is what happened the very next day.
This is wild.
He traveled to a park in Rapa Nui with his young children. They're just having a normal day. Two children walk up and they have a large dog with them. Dixon immediately feels what he calls a check in his spirit. A deep, intuitive warning not to trust the animal.
Okay.
The dog initially seems perfectly calm. But then it walks right up to Dixon, puts its face about a foot away from his, and stares at him with these deceptively kind eyes.
Mirroring the exact terrifying positioning of the angry dog in his dream the night before.
Exactly. And just as Dixon reaches out, about to pet this seemingly calm dog, the owner comes sprinting out of a nearby car, screaming at the top of her lungs, "Go home! Get away from him!" The owner then tells a shocked Dixon that this dog is incredibly dangerous, has a history of attacking without any warning whatsoever, despite looking perfectly calm, and shouldn't even be allowed out on the streets.
For Dixon, this was undeniable, empirical proof that spiritual attacks often preview themselves in the dream realm before manifesting as literal physical threats. The dream was a warning of a physical danger that was about to present itself wrapped in a harmless exterior.
Exactly like a wolf in sheep's clothing. The dog looked totally calm and friendly, but as a predator waiting for the exact moment to strike. And aside from these dream assaults, the sources detail a second, highly tangible vector for spiritual contamination, physical objects. Cursed items.
According to Dixon and the synthesis document, intentional infiltrators frequently use physical objects, books, jewelry, pieces of art, or seemingly benign, thoughtful gifts to introduce demonic contamination into a church or specifically into a leader's home.
Just giving someone a cursed gift.
Yeah. These objects, they claim, are spiritually dedicated on occult altars, prayed over with curses before being wrapped up and handed over as a friendly gesture.
They act as spiritual landing strips.
Exactly. I want to explain the theological mechanism here because it relies on the concept of legal spiritual rights.
Okay, let's hear it.
In this worldview, demons are highly legalistic entities. They need a legal right to occupy space. If a Christian's home is prayed over and dedicated to God, a demon cannot just wander in.
The door is locked.
Right. However, if the homeowner willingly accepts a cursed object and brings it into their house, that object serves as an anchor point. It gives the demonic entity a legal authorized footprint inside the perimeter, enabling the infiltrator to project oppression, sickness, or confusion directly into the environment of the person who innocently accepted the gift.
Okay, stop right there. Let me wrap my head around this, because here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Here's where I have to heavily push back on behalf of you, the listener. We've talked about broken microphones, sudden sickness, bad dreams, and gifted jewelry carrying curses.
Well, all the strange stuff, yeah.
If a listener, a pastor, or a manager starts applying this framework literally to their daily life, isn't there a massive, terrifying danger here?
Oh, absolutely.
If I start analyzing every bad dream I have, every time the office printer jams, or every time someone gives me a weird necklace as a sign that a witch is actively cursing me, doesn't that just breed absolute toxic, organizational paranoia? You would be jumping at shadows. You'd turn into a witch hunter, literally.
That is the exact critical vulnerability of this entire theological framework, and it is a phenomenal pushback. If misapplied, if wielded by an insecure or paranoid leader, it absolutely breeds toxic paranoia.
It would have to.
And it inevitably leads to the horrific scapegoating of completely innocent people. The sources themselves and the experts who synthesize this theology, they're acutely aware of this danger.
So they address it.
Yes. They recognize that misdiagnosing a wounded, struggling, or just socially awkward believer as an occult agent results in severe spiritual and psychological abuse.
But at the same time, the sources argue that ignoring a true agent out of fear of being paranoid leads to the destruction of the entire organization.
Mm.
You can't just hug a termite and hope it stops eating the wood because you want to be tolerant.
Exactly. So you need a test. You need a reliable way to prove who is who.
Okay, what's the best?
This is why the experts walk leadership through a very strict, multidimensional diagnostic matrix.
A matrix.
The matrix is designed to differentiate between an immature, annoying, or backslidden Christian and a conscious, hostile, occult infiltrator. Let's break down the dimensions of this test in detail. The first dimension is analyzing intent and motivation.
Right. Because an immature believer might cause a lot of drama, but their core intent isn't evil.
Right, exactly.
They just lack discipline, or they are acting out of unhealed emotional wounds. A backslidden Christian might be distracted by worldly things, or they might be holding on to a petty personal offense.
But the wolf, the occult agent, is consciously hostile. Their hidden motivation is a specific assignment to divide, conquer, and subvert the ministry.
But intent is invisible. So how do you test it?
That brings us to the second and perhaps most vital practical dimension of the matrix, their response to correction.
Oh, okay.
How does the individual react when a leader directly confronts their disruptive behavior? An immature person might be embarrassed, they might get defensive or cry at first, but over time, they are teachable. They eventually respond to instruction and change their behavior.
But the infiltrator, the sources say they exhibit what they call feigned submission.
Feigned submission.
And to ground this in reality, if you have ever dealt with a narcissist who uses therapy speak to avoid apologizing, you know exactly what this looks like.
Oh, yeah.
They weaponize the rules of the group. If a pastor sits them down and says, "You need to stop gossiping and causing division in the women's Bible study," the infiltrator won't say, "You're right, I'm sorry."
No, they will deflect using that ultra-spiritual camouflage. They will say things like, "Pastor, I wasn't gossiping. The Lord gave me a prophetic warning about that sister, and I was just sharing it for intercession."
So manipulative.
"You are trying to silence the voice of God. You are quenching the spirit." They use spirituality as an impenetrable shield against organizational authority.
Which is infuriating for a leader. And that brings us to the third dimension of the matrix, which is highly, uniquely specific to this charismatic context, reaction to deliverance.
Right, deliverance.
This means exposing the person to intense, authoritative prayer.
The premise here is that demons cannot hide forever in the presence of true spiritual authority. If a person is simply struggling emotionally, intense prayer usually brings them a sense of peace, an emotional release like crying, or a sense of gentle conviction.
But the true agent.
According to the sources, the true agent exhibits violent, demonic agitation when exposed to direct spiritual authority.
Pastor Locke's account gives a terrifyingly visceral example of this. He talks about his own student leader, a young man named Jesse, who had to go through a deliverance session.
Yes, I remember this.
Jesse himself testified that the moment Locke started praying in the name of Jesus, the demons inside him started getting terrified. Jesse's friend, who was sitting outside the office in the hallway during the session, described the sound coming from the room. He said, "Jesse, this normal guy suddenly sounded like a caveman discovering fire."
It is an incredibly graphic description, and we need to ELI-5 why this happens within their paradigm. Why the physical violence? Why the animalistic sounds?
Yeah, why?
In this theology, demons are, as we said, legalistic entities occupying physical space within the host. They do not want to leave. They view the body as their house.
Right.
So the violent shaking, the screaming, the animalistic vocalizations, it is viewed literally as an eviction process. It is the spiritual entity violently resisting the physical expulsion from its territory.
So within their paradigm, that extreme physical manifestation is the absolute empirical proof that they are dealing with a hostile spiritual entity, not just a psychological block, a personality disorder, or a bad attitude.
Exactly. The diagnostic matrix is deliberately designed to push the hidden entity into the light,
stripping away the ultra-spiritual camouflage and forcing it to react so it can be definitively identified.
The matrix forces the issue.
Okay, so let's say a leadership team runs the matrix. The physical chaos is there, the printer is broken, the leadership is sick, the relational chaos is there.
All the signs.
The person in the Bible study is deflecting all correction with super spiritual jargon. And when they finally try to pray with them, the person physically manifests rage. The matrix confirms you have an active infiltrator. A wolf is in the house. What happens next? How must the organization react to protect itself?
This brings us to the final critical phase of the deep dive, countermeasures and boundary enforcement. And the sources are absolutely emphatic that this process must start internally with the leadership themselves before they ever address the infiltrator.
The internal audit, addressing leadership vulnerability.
Yes. The historical analyses within the deliverance tradition emphasize a sobering reality. An infiltrator can only gain a controlling foothold in a ministry if the leadership harbors secret sin, greed, personal ambition, or pride.
Because they need a legal landing pad.
Exactly. If the leadership is compromised by hidden sin, they have no spiritual authority to cast out the infiltrator. The demons will simply ignore them or expose the leader's hypocrisy.
Wow.
Therefore, the absolute first line of defense is a rigorous internal audit, repenting of sin, maintaining a clean heart, and ensuring the leadership is morally and spiritually above reproach.
You cannot clean the house if your own hands are covered in mud. Once the leadership is clean, they move to active neutralization. This means aggressively dismantling the infiltrator's work piece by piece.
Right.
It involves publicly or privately renouncing those ungodly soul ties to break the codependency they established with vulnerable members.
And it also heavily involves dealing with those physical vectors of contamination we talked about. They instruct members to identify and physically destroy any of those cursed items or seemingly benign gifts brought in by the suspected agent.
Which again, Greg Locke did. Quite literally and very famously.
He did.
He made international headlines for holding a massive book burning event at his church. He aggressively urged his congregants to go through their homes, find what he called evil garbage, tarot cards, crystals, voodoo dolls, Ouija boards, and even young adult fantasy books like Harry Potter and Twilight.
Yeah.
Bring them to the church and throw them into a massive bonfire.
Why do you think they insist on physical fire? Why not just throw them in the dumpster?
Because fire is absolute. It is a highly aggressive, visible, and symbolic countermeasure. It represents both a spiritual purification and a physical severance of the legal landing strip.
Right.
You aren't just tossing it out. You are actively destroying the bridge the enemy used to enter your home.
Precisely. And that extreme aggression in destroying objects translates directly to how they handle the infiltrator personally.
Okay.
The final step is enforcing boundaries. While traditional mainstream pastoral care generally focuses on endless patience, grace, and the ultimate restoration of all individuals, this specific framework dictates that the safety of the flock supersedes the comfort or restoration of the wolf.
So what do?
They insist on strict, immediate physical removal.
And again, Locke did exactly this. In a viral, highly controversial sermon, he announced from the pulpit that he had the names of 6 suspected witches currently sitting in his congregation.
Right.
Names he claimed were actually revealed to him by a demon during a deliverance session. He forcefully and publicly called them out, threatened to expose them by name to the entire town, and literally chased them out of the church tent. He told them, "You so much as cough wrong and I'll expose you."
It is a radical, jarring departure from mainstream church discipline.
I have to push back here on the theology because this is where the friction is highest.
Okay, let's hear it.
Wait. He chased them out of a tent. But what about the fundamental Christian tenet of grace and forgiveness? If a church is, as the saying goes, a hospital for sinners, how do they legally, theologically speaking, justify just throwing a sick person out into the cold? Doesn't that violate the core message of Christianity?
That is the exact criticism levied against Locke by mainstream theologians. But the deliverance ministries and the sources we are studying defend this by pointing to a specific, dangerous misreading of the wheat and the tares parable.
Right. For those who don't know, that is the parable where Jesus says an enemy planted weeds among the wheat, and the master says to let them both grow together until the harvest, lest you uproot the good wheat by mistake.
Right.
Usually that is interpreted as leave the judgment to God at the end of time. Don't try to root out the bad people yourself because you might hurt the innocent ones.
But these sources argue that applying the wheat and the tares parable to an active, destructive occult agent is organizational suicide.
Oh, interesting.
They argue that parable is about general human sinfulness, not active saboteurs. They point to other scriptures about casting out wolves and handing unrepentant people over to Satan so their souls might be saved.
Okay.
In their view, you do not leave a literal hungry wolf in the sheep pen and wait for the harvest to sort it out. You cast it out immediately to protect the innocent sheep.
It is an extreme zero-tolerance policy.
Yeah.
And I think it's vital to note how Locke defends this incredibly aggressive stance. When the secular media and even other mainstream Christians criticized him for being abusive, unhinged, or paranoid, Locke doubled down.
He really did.
He claimed that the sheer volume of curses, hexes, and media backlash hitting his church after that event was actually empirical proof that he was doing the right thing.
In his view, when you expose deeply embedded darkness, it doesn't just pack its bags and leave quietly. It throws a violent tantrum. The chaos, the media circus, the backlash. It isn't proof that you are crazy or wrong. It is proof that you struck a massive spiritual nerve.
Which perfectly encapsulates the entire worldview we've been exhaustively examining today. It is a world of constant high-stakes conflict, where the unseen realm dictates the absolute health, structure, and survival of the physical organization.
It is an intense paradigm, but it offers a fascinating lens on human behavior, manipulation, and the lengths communities will go to protect their core integrity.
So let's summarize this massive deep dive for you, the listener.
Yeah.
If we extract the core mechanics from these charismatic sources, identifying a wolf in sheep's clothing requires a highly multifaceted, vigilant approach.
Very vigilant.
You have to look far past their ultra-spiritual, highly devoted, performative camouflage. You have to track the physical, statistical, and atmospheric chaos they leave in their wake, the inexplicably broken systems, the sudden bizarre illnesses, the fractured leadership relationships.
And finally.
Yes, finally, you have to apply a strict, unforgiving diagnostic matrix, testing their true intent and watching closely how they react to correction and absolute authority.
It is a comprehensive, albeit severe, system of organizational defense. But as we close this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought.
Oh, I'm ready.
And it is based on one of the most unsettling concepts Mark Dixon introduced at the very beginning of our discussion, the blind witch.
The toxic middle manager. The unsecured Wi-Fi network.
Exactly. Dixon posits that a person can be an active agent of destruction without ever consciously realizing it.
That's terrifying.
They don't need a coven. They don't need to burn sage or cast a formal hex. They just need to allow fear, control, and manipulation to dictate their prayers, their actions, and their relationships.
Wow.
They genuinely think they are the hero of the story, but they're the termite eating the floorboards.
Which flips the entire script of this deep dive on its head.
It does. It means that the most vital question isn't always looking outward. The goal isn't just to ask who is infiltrating my organization, who is the witch in the pew or the cubicle next to me.
Wow. Okay, so what is the real question we should be asking?
The real question to mull over is this. How often do we, driven by our own unseen fears, our unhealed wounds, and our desperate desires for control, unknowingly act as the very wolves we are trying so desperately to root out?
That is a heavy, heavy thought to leave on. Are we the ones rotting our own floorboards?
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep examining your foundations. Keep testing the structures around you. And as always, keep questioning the world and the unseen forces around you.